Hi everyone, this is Chris DC, and it was such a joy for this week's Nostalgia interview to catch up with Rachel Jeffery, who works at the University of Kent as Diversity Mark Officer. Rachel is also doing a PhD. Now, Rachel, who is originally from Suriname and later moved to the Netherlands, talks about why calendars and anniversary dates and photographs are so important to her. She can relive the original feelings she had when she looks back at pictures. Rachel tells us why she selects happy moments and why the camera is like an extended eye. We also discuss how other people may interact differently with them, even those in the same picture. And Rachel talks about the role that pictures play in her cultural background. They represent the most important thing in one's life and all of one's accomplishments. Now, Rachel talks about the time that she was asked what the object was from childhood that means the most to her. We find out about Rachel's attachment to objects, including jewellery. There's a necklace that reminds Rachel of her time in Colombia when she was diagnosed with a heart defect. She was told that she didn't have long to live. She was told to do something that she wanted to do as she didn't have much time left. She ended up in St. Martin, where she had a second opinion and discovered that she wasn't terminally ill after all. Now, the necklace symbolizes her having new life and a second chance. She now faces sickness in a completely new way. We learn that music played a big role in Rachel's upbringing. We learn that lockdown had a huge impact on the connections which live music brings. Now, we find out whether there are any inspiring artists. And she discusses a photo that she brought with her to the recording of herself with Kimani Marley, son of Bob. Rachel talks about her educational journey. She worked as a social worker in St. Martin, and she taught in Suriname. And then she went on to do a master's in social anthropology, and now is doing her PhD. And actually, surprisingly, I asked Rachel how she ended up in Canterbury, and her answer is not one I was expecting, if I'm honest. At the very end of the interview, Rachel talks about how she believes that in the context of her Christian faith, everything happens for a reason. The health diagnosis was an attack on her faith, but afterwards, her faith returned. And Rachel explains why she lives through the past, in the present, looking at the future. Rachel is such an infectious person. She was a wonderful person to catch up with. This is a joyous interview to do. It was a delight to catch up for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews with Rachel Jeffery. My name is Chris DC. Well, it is a great pleasure to have Rachel Jeffery with me today. And we're actually doing a face-to-face interview. And I'm very excited because you've come completely prepared for this interview with all sorts of photographs and jewellery. And we're going to talk about nostalgia through a very specific cultural lens. Do you want to say something, Rachel, first of all, about what you do at the University of Kent?
Yeah. So thank you, Chris, for having me. I know I am over-enthusiastic. And maybe it's the anthropologist in me that I've worked with all these objects that I have. But I'm doing my PhD in social anthropology here at Kent. And I'm in my third year, actually the extension of my third year going into my fourth year. And I'm also working at the student success team. I'm working with the student success team. And my role is a diversity mark officer. And for now, I have assigned the Center for Journalism and School of Arts.
So you've been here for a few years?
Yeah. Okay. So basically, the amount of years that I'm here in Canterbury is also the same as my years at Kent University since 2016. It's the 6th of September 2016 is when my husband and I came to the UK, and that's when I also started at Kent University. I did my master's here. And after my master's, I went straight into my PhD.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you gave me some very specific dates there. Mm-hmm. And I'm fascinated in the degree to which dates play a role, anniversaries play a role in your life.
Oh, yeah.
And how you got to where you are today.
Yeah. Dates are important because it signifies an ending of a certain time period. I have to say, some of my English will sound funny because I speak Dutch. Dutch is my first language. But anyhow, dates are important to us, so me and my husband. So, for instance, I know exactly when I moved from Suriname to Sint Maarten, because we moved first from Suriname to Sint Maarten, and that was on the 10th of October 2010. So, and then we moved from Sint Maarten to the Netherlands. We stayed in the Netherlands for just 2 weeks, 1 week, if I'm not mistaken. But anyhow, we moved on the 17th of August 2016 is when we moved to England. And the reason why I have these dates captured is because it signifies me, how do you say it? A change, something new happening, something different happening, something ending, a certain period of time ending, and then going into another, yeah.
And what about anniversaries in that sense? Because it sounds like with all of those dates that you've mentioned, and because we're talking in October, the 13th today, but and the dates that you've given are all around then.
Today is the 13th of October. It's the day that my husband and I first met. 20 years ago.
Yeah. Is this a memory thing in the sense that, I mean, do you mark this? Do you have some form of diary or calendar, or do you use photographs? Is there a particular way of commemorating and demarcating these important
events?
Well,
my husband has this obsession with calendars, and he would specifically have the birthday calendars, and that's where he would write down all the birthdays, anniversaries, and all of that. For me, I am more related. So I am more focused on dates that say something about me, my own journey. And those are not marked in calendars, but on a calendar, but more specifically with pictures. Because I can go back to that moment. I can go back to the pictures. I can look at the picture and I can relive the feeling that I had. Because like I said, it signifies what I felt, why, what happened around that time, or in what sort of space I was in that time. So anniversaries is my wedding, which is the 20th. I have to laugh because my husband and I are always back and forth with this thing. Sometimes I have to take off my ring just to see, was it 2002 or was it 2000? It was 2002, the 20th of December, 2002. That was our marriage.
So you got the date inscribed?
In our rings.
Yeah. It's funny what you say about dates, because yesterday I happened to be asked to write the foreword to a book that somebody, it's a sequel that somebody was writing. He's now in his 80s, living in Australia. And the first version of the book came out about 30 years ago. Mm. I remember it would have been something like January 1998, that one Saturday morning, I was going through this book and I was doing my PhD at the time, making all these notes. Yeah. And this is the really funny thing. Yesterday, because I always used to like record songs off the radio, and I remember on that day what I was listening to. Yeah. And yesterday in the car, so I wrote the foreword to this book, just got in the car, and then put my music tapes on, because I digitized all my tapes years ago. Yeah. And it was at exactly that spot that day in January 1998, where I was, you know, first came across this author's work. Now that happens. I mean, we all have those synchronicity moments, but it sounds like in your case, when you mentioned as well experiencing on the days the events, what form does that take? Do you sort of almost like feel that you're transported back to those primary events?
Oh yeah. If I look at the pictures, it's like I'm reliving the moment. You see. How shall I explain it? Well, one explanation, and that's now that you're saying it, I am thinking, you know what? It definitely has to do with the way how I feel. Because as I was selecting pictures of certain highlights in my life, I specifically selected pictures that signifies happy moments, right? And the reason why is because I wanted to sound happy. But in those pictures, you know, I brought a picture of our house, you know, the first time in our own house. No, I can't find a picture, but anyhow, it was our own house that we've built. And the picture is actually about my husband doing the barbecue. And that was like our first week in the house. So he's doing the barbecue outside of the house. But there are also pictures of his mother. And I didn't bring those pictures. The reason why is because she's recently passed away. And I didn't want to go back to that moment. Because then, you know, it was a nice experience. But if I have to look back to this picture where she's sitting, I cannot relive the happiness that we had then. It's more because she's passed away way too early. So it doesn't really resonate with happiness anymore. So I left that picture out. I was like, no, I don't want it. Can't find this picture. But
the role of photographs, I think, is so incredible because, I mean, these days you can take so many on phones, but these are photographs which obviously perhaps in some cases precede, certainly the current obsession with printing. You know, obviously these days you don't print out a picture, but you brought a wonderful array of printed photographs.
Yes. I almost spoke Dutch by saying bewust. But I mean, the word is not for spite, but I was conscious. I consciously selected pictures that I didn't take with my phone.
Yeah.
And the reason why is because also the way how I received those pictures. For instance, this one is a picture of my husband and I. We had a business in Suriname and we would do catering and we would do brunches and all of that. And this was actually a challenge. We participated in a business challenge and I was so nervous because I had to set up like a fruit buffet. And I had two other friends who were Brazilians and they are magnificent in crafting figurines in fruits. So the watermelon that's in a swan, that's what they did. But I was just so nervous that day that I didn't even think about taking pictures. And then one of them took the picture and I never knew that he did. It's only when I won the prize for my fruit buffet that he sent me the picture. Yeah. He gave me this picture. And he said, well, now you have a picture that signifies that moment. You see? So that's why I said, I'm going to take pictures that have been, it wasn't just snapped, you know, with my phone and it's in my phone and I printed it. This is a tangible object, like this one, for instance, with my dad. You know, this is also a picture that we weren't aware that a friend of ours who was, how do you say it, Peace Corps, and he took these pictures. And after the wedding, what is with the Broodsweker? After my honeymoon. And then he sent us he gave me the pictures as, you know, an extra present. And this is my dad. And as you can see, my dad looks very worried because we were late to go to. So, that's why I brought these.
And it's funny because I'm guessing that at the time, certainly when I was young, you know, you get sick of people taking photographs. You're like, oh, you have to pose for the photograph and it's a real effort. But now I crave those photographs. And it sounds like in your case, because you weren't sure if the catering event was going to go okay, the last thing you want is somebody photographing that, because they could be photographing something that's terribly embarrassing and so on. But now, of course, that is the most precious object you can have. And also, do you find that it's like a kind of corroboration that not just that something happened, but that it happened in the way that you remember it? Or maybe actually the photograph changes the interpretation, you know, as to whether, because you've outlined it could have been a disastrous event, but it wasn't. But the photograph is proof that it was actually all okay.
Yeah.
And you must feel a sense of what, gratitude when you see the photograph?
Yeah, well, in some cases, other cases not.
But you haven't brought those photographs.
But there's a funny one, and the funny one is on our wedding day. Let me just go through it again. On our wedding, this is still my the other event, but going through the wedding day pictures, So this is a picture for on our wedding day, right? This was also taken and all of that. We've received them. The photograph gave it to us. The photographer gave it to us after we came back from our honeymoon, etc. And my husband and I were going through the pictures. Like what you're saying, you don't know what the camera captures.
Yeah.
In artificial anthropology, we say the eye of the, you know, the camera is an extended eye. And my husband and I was going through it, and we were like, oh, well, this is nice. nice, this is nice. And then we came across a picture where you could see in the background that catering personnel, so it's not this one, it's because I've left that one home, but in the back of the picture, you could see the catering personnel just sitting relaxed and drinking, you know. And I was like, well, what? So we've paid them. Yeah. And there was just a moment where they were just sitting relaxed as if they were also guests. Yeah. So as you say, sometimes the camera captures something completely different than what you imagined happened that day.
And also the way in which sometimes people who may have been, or in your memory, were at a particular event, but there's no sort of proof of it, or vice versa. Yeah. The occasions when somebody appears in a photograph and you think, what were they doing there on that day at that time?
Oh, yeah.
And then what it does in terms of the way that you assimilate the past, you try and work out how you knew somebody, whether they knew other people, and all this sort of join the dots, which I think is far more important than a lot of people give credit, because it's easy. It's easy sometimes to say, oh, it happened 30 years ago. Who cares? We all move on. But it does matter, because you wouldn't be. I mean, I wouldn't be where I am today if it wasn't for a certain set of things that happened with a certain set of people at a certain time and place. And there's a sense of indebtedness to some of those people. It sounds as though you've had very similar experiences.
If I have to think of what you're saying, without certain people in my life, where would I have been? And then I'm looking at this one, right? Because I keep talking about our honeymoon, etc. And when my husband and I got married, well, we were both figuring out life. Didn't have a house. Our jobs weren't that good paid jobs. But after the wedding, we ended up in the most exclusive hotel. Yeah. And it was my mother's uncle who had it as a present for us. And he was also the one who drove me in that exclusive car. You know, so these are people that have contributed something to your life. And again, when you look at the picture, you can go back. And even though he's not in the picture, because he's the one who took this picture, because he dropped us off at the hotel and he took the picture for us. And it was around Christmas time, you know, and where my husband and I were thinking, well, after the wedding, the most important thing is that we should get married. That's it. But it's these people around us who has made it happen. The same goes for my friend. I was talking about the Peace Corps friend, right? His wife is here in the back because he took the picture. And he wanted to capture the family that was there that day. But Arthur, that's his name, he came into my life. And actually, he was my first experience with I want to say outside world, but it sounds funny. But what I mean is with the other world. You know, he's American. When I met him, he came to work for our NGO. It was a women's NGO. And he came in with his American view on things and his knowledge about, you know, westernized knowledge on how we should help these grassroots women and all of that. And that was my first exposure to the American way of thinking, the American life, and up till this day, we are friends.
Yeah.
But he has added something to my life, you know, and I can talk about it just by looking at the picture.
And do you find that the people in the photograph themselves, do you find that it's a shared ritual, or do you sometimes find that other people who are in the same photograph sometimes just don't necessarily feel about them the same way as you? And how do you navigate that? Because obviously, you have a particular set of dispositions, you know, happiness in terms of all of these here.
Yeah.
But do you find sometimes that you have to be very cautious about what you show and in the right context?
It depends on the setting as well. You know, who are you going to be? Who am I showing these pictures? Yeah. Because maybe that experience is not the same as what I, you know, felt. I'm trying to think of a picture that I might. Here it is. This was the picture for our house.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely. Because my experience isn't necessarily the same, you know, as others who are in the picture. For instance, well, this is a friend of my mom, and my mom's friend for years. But I don't know if the picture is going to have the same value for her as it does to me. I don't think so.
Yeah.
And then again, there can be pictures that you don't want to show someone because it could have been a quite interesting moment for you, but then you don't know how the person who is also in the picture would relate to that moment. You know?
And I'm thinking about your work in anthropology as well, because the role of, you know, in terms of sacred objects, sacred rituals, but photographs, because it's so interesting that you've come with photographs, because, I mean, I suppose I work a lot with films, but I suppose I keep a diary.
Yeah.
I suppose I tend to be a bit more written in, or, you know, even if I watch a film, I've got like a written, like a summary of every film I watch. So I sort of would come prepared in that sense. But in your case here, in terms of your background, your culture and your research, do photographs play a really prominent role? You know, is it just you, or is that something very much emblematic of your own family background, cultural background?
Cultural background.
Yeah.
It is, you know, in, now speaking from my cultural background, which in this specific case is Surinamese Creole, pictures represent, how do you say it? They represent richness of life. So when you're sitting with friends and families, if you want to engage them into your life, you do it with the pictures. And the reason why you show the pictures is because it's also some sort of evidence.
Yeah.
I'm not just saying, and I think you might have noticed it. I'm not just saying it. I'm showing you. This is it.
Yeah.
You know, the pictures, some pictures also capture moments where you have achieved status, and then you want to show it, you know. But at the same time, the picture also how do you say it, represents your growth. Your depth, your ability to give depth to your relationships, the amount of friends that I have, the relationships that I have established along the way, the places where I've been along the way. And I remember one of my managers who I was working with, the same NGO that I was talking about, the grassroots NGO, she said, you know, when I travel, I rather invest in pictures, because when a burglar comes in your house, pictures is the last thing that they will take. But at the same time, pictures represent the most valuable thing in your life, because you can go back to the picture. It represents what you have experienced in life. It has captured all your accomplishments. Mm. So, yeah.
And in some cases, some of these photographs here are not posed, because some of them are, but some of them are sort of natural shots or shots where the other person, well, they may know the photograph is being taken. That wouldn't be known to me.
Yeah.
But I think that's an important thing as well, because we all, you know, sometimes when people pose for photographs, they display a radiant smile that they may not always display. So, or my grandmother, who would always take her glasses off for a photograph, but she always wore her glasses. So there are lots of pictures of when I was young of her without glasses, and of course that's not the way I remember her. But because now the only way to remember her, apart from obviously my memory, is through those photographs, but she's not here anymore, then I see her without the glasses. So that's a slightly distorted image, because as soon as the photograph was taken, she put them back on again. So photographs, I mean, I think that they can, not lie, that's the wrong word for it, but they can give a particular perspective on something which may not accord with the way in which we, you know, we particularly see something.
And that's why we go for the natural things. It has to be as natural as possible. Yeah. Not too much of posing, as natural as possible, because then you can show people what the in Dutch we say sphere, what does the atmosphere, what the vibe was, You know, that's what you want to show people. You want to show people the fight. You see, for this one, there is no moment where the photographer told me, okay, pose, and he told my husband to kneel down and all of that. No, we were all just moving around, doing our thing. The only pictures that are staged, so to speak, are these, you know, where I stand with, where I am with my dad, but this is not staged at all.
Yeah.
You know, this one is my uncle is just saying, well, stand there. But most of the pictures are capture moments because you want to reflect what the fight was.
Yeah. And I'm guessing as well that when you look at these photographs, you're aware, not just because obviously aging, you know, but which we all have to, you know, think, did I look like that? But
I don't want to look at this.
But also, the whole interplay between where you were, where you are now, and, you know, I'm guessing that even from a period of time before you may even have photographs, when you were sort of, you know, very young growing up, or don't have the photographs here anyway, what are your earliest memories? What is there anything from childhood that you'd sort of look back on and perhaps in some ways see it as like a counterpoint or a counterpart to where you are now? Is there anything from your past that you think, gosh, you know, I still have these interests, so there are certain things that you've never forgotten. Is there anything that you particularly sort of that encapsulates that period of your life?
Yeah, I am laughing because I was working with a friend of mine on this project, Things That Talk, and I was also very much prepared for all the objects surrounding me that I want him to talk about. And then he came with this question, what is your earliest memory of an object that has had an impact on you?
Yeah.
And I was for a bit taken aback because I wasn't prepared for it, because I felt like I had to go back to that childhood.
Yeah.
And it's such a long, long way back. But if coming back to your question, if I have to think of, there's no picture of it, but there is this moment that I have in mind, memory, is when I won my first book, and I had to write, I guess they say essay, but for a child it's not an essay. You had to write a little story, just a fictional story, and it was in order for the library, the community library, to help us upgrade our skills, writing skills. But I love to write. And I still like writing. And that's my earliest memory, that I won the prize for that little story that I wrote, and I received a book for it. And that was the object that I could mention to the interviewer about the very first object that has been part of my life.
Yeah. And is that object still with you today?
No.
No? Yeah.
No, no. It was a little fairy tale book. It was a fairy tale about a dwarf. But I don't have it anymore.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. What about your attachment to objects? Because even in terms of the jewellery, because before we started recording, you mentioned that you were wearing particularly important jewellery to you. But the role of objects, as we're seeing for photographs, is clearly a really foundational experience.
Yeah. My attachment to objects, you can actually say is the same with pictures.
Yeah.
Because it represents something that has happened in my life and that has had an impact on my life. It didn't just happen. And because you were speaking about nostalgia, and I could remember the question that you had for someone else, whether or not nostalgia also relates to events that are not so...
Negative experiences.
Negative experience. So this necklace that I have here with those rocks... it actually symbolizes my time in Colombia, because when I was in St. Martin, my moving to St. Martin had to do with the fact that I had a heart, they discovered in Suriname a heart disease, that I had a heart disease, but they couldn't really say what it was. So in Suriname, they actually find out that I had a heart disease. And I was devastated because it came with the message that I didn't have long to live. Just like that. That's how the doctor said it to me. It's long emboli. I don't know what the Dutch word is for that. The English word is, but in Dutch we say long emboli, something with my lungs and embolies. And usually people live for, say, around 5 years, or 3 years, I wasn't feeling anything. The only issue that I had is that I would get tired quick, but that was it. So he said, you should think of something, you should think of doing something fun because you might not have long to live. And that was before I turned 30. So my sister was in Suriname. That's my older sister. And this was around December time. And in December, one of the most fancy hotels in Suriname organizes, ball mask.
Like a fancy dress type mask.
Yeah, you have to be a masquerade. Yeah. Yeah. So it's a very fancy thing, something that I wouldn't be able to pay. But she paid for it because of the message that I received. And I still have this scarf. So she said, we will go, we will have fun, we will forget about this whole message and blah, blah, blah. So we went to the event. This was the most happy moment that I had with my sister, even though I had received that devastating news. And when she left, when she came back to return to Holland, my husband and I was thinking, well, what are we going to do? So that's where we decided change of scenery. We just leave Suriname. If I only have 3 more years or 5 more years to live, we might as well do something fun. You know, we don't have children. We don't know where life will end. So let's see where we can go. Started the whole process of looking for a place to go. We ended up in Sint Maarten. Obviously, if I go to Sint Maarten, I have to walk with all my doctor's information and all of that because I was on medication. Came in Sint Maarten, handed my, my medical file to the GP. And the GP was also from Suriname. And he said, well, this sounds strange because I have a niece in Holland who is diagnosed with the same disease. And she is practically not even able to walk. So this is strange. I feel like we should do a second opinion. Do you want to do a second opinion? And I was at the point where I was like, well, anything that we can do, because I don't care. The doctor said, I have 3-5 more years. Let's go. It doesn't matter to me. So there was this cardiologist on the island from Holland. She went through the file and she said the same thing. No, there's something wrong. This is not adding up. Do you want to go through a whole second opinion, but that means that for a week you will have to go through a lot of tests and all of that. And I said, yeah, fine. Went through the whole process of tests and etc. And that's where they find out that the diagnosis of Suriname was wrong. There was no situation of me having lung embolism. There was no situation of me going to die in a couple of years. And she said, this what you have is very easy to resolve. All we have to do is we either flown to Holland or Colombia. And in Colombia, Bogota, they are specialists in cardiologic heart surgery. And she said, all that needs to be done is they need to put in a sort of umbrella thing because there was an opening in the heart.
That sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. There was an opening in the heart. And it, she said it's a really easy surgery thing that needs to be done. Do you want to do it? And I said, yes, fine. This is good news. Anything that can change the script, because I am happy to hear that I have to live. So it was arranged and all. Chose Bogota because obviously that's, you know, much more. By that time, it was much more relatable to me to go to Bogota. And when I came in Bogota, the first, when we arrived in the hotel, the hotel has some sort of a, how do you say it? When you go to the museum, you have these little shops where you can buy all these like memorable.
Gift shop.
So the hotel had a gift shop. And on my last day, the surgery was done, all of that. The lady in the gift shop says, well, everything went well. And I said, yes, I'm new again. I'm stepping into life again. This whole story about me not living too long, it has gone. And she said, well, then you should buy something to make it memorable. Obviously, it was a marketing thing. Yeah. But that's where I picked these stones. And that's why I said, I'm going to bring this necklace, because I think it's a good conversation to say that nostalgia about the negative experience turned into a positive one. And it signifies me obtaining new life. You know, the necklace symbolizes, that's the word, it symbolizes me having new life. Yeah.
I mean, that's actually an incredible story, because you went, you know, you knew that your life was finite. You knew that there was an imminent-ish endpoint. Mm-hmm. But when you had then the correct diagnosis, I'm guessing there was a mixture of relief, but also anger as well, perhaps, at the fact that you'd been put through this.
The anger was not so much, because I was so relieved that I got the news that I have to live. Mm. But my dad... My dad was like, well, we should go back to that doctor in Suriname and we should show him that you are still living and I want you to send me copies. Yes. My dad was furious.
Yeah, I bet.
But I was done with it, Chris. Yeah. For me, it was end of chapter, new chapter.
Yeah.
I'm done with it. I'm relieved. I'm thankful, grateful that I get to live. And let's move on.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting because I teach a course called Death and the Afterlife. In fact, I'm teaching it tomorrow morning.
Oh.
And we look at near-death experiences
yeah.
and the impact that people who've died but come back to life have and the way it changes their life. Yeah. What you've outlined, it feels kind of similar because you were facing imminent death.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then it gave you, from what you're telling me, a real sort of zest, a renewal of life.
Yes, yes, a renewal of life, but also being grateful, but also the gratefulness comes with the fact that you have a second chance. That's the word, a second chance. Yeah. And you have to make it work. This is a second chance. You have to make it work. And from there, I have faced sickness in a complete different way. Yeah. If I am confronted with feeling sick or whatsoever, I'm always like, oh no, I have escaped that. So this is not going to break me. I'm going through, you know, I have been at the border of...
Yeah, death's door.
Yeah. So... whatever comes to my path, I feel like, well, it's a second chance. I have to push through. I have to go for it. Yeah.
Does it have an impact on you in terms of ensuring that when it comes to decisions that you make, you know, are you more impulsive or are you less cautious or more cautious than you were before?
It depends on what decisions I make. To give you an example, I have become much more... cautious when I have to be separated from my husband.
Mm-hmm.
If, for instance, when I had to go to the field, the decision to go to do field work in Suriname was an impulsive one, because I felt this whole nostalgic thing. I'm going back to Suriname after 10 years. I'm going to do my research there. I'm returning as a PhD student and all of that.
Yeah.
And then when I realize that it's going to be without my husband being in the field for a year, that's where fear knocked in. And I felt like, oh gosh, I'm going to be separated from him for so long. And I needed confirmations from a lot of people around me, you know, confirm to me, to say that, yes, it's a good decision. Go, just go. And I took the step to go. And when I entered the field, that's where Corona stepped in.
Right, yeah.
Because it was in 2019. Yeah. Corona stepped in, and then there was this fear again, because he was all the way here in England by himself. I was all the way in Suriname. Everywhere was in lockdown. There were no flights, nothing. So I almost felt like this is the end. And that was the first time when I felt this fear and this anxiety, like when I had my
diagnosis,
this exact same, because I felt like, what is this? I felt trapped, you know, so from an impulsive, which I like to take impulsive decisions. So as soon as there was a possibility for me to return to the UK, I immediately returned. And from since that day, I'm not going anywhere.
Yeah.
Too far without him.
Yeah.
You know, the other day I had to go to Brixton to meet up some friends, And I arranged it in such a way that my husband could come with me. And even though he was going to be in the area, but just the idea of being separated so far from each other was for, you know, with the possibility that I could be limited to come back to him. That's the only thing that has remained. But other than that, I can be very impulsive.
Yeah. I'm just thinking as well, in terms of a lot of the, you know, the background cultural interest, music, for example, in terms of your sort of growing up, are there any particular, I mean, the ways of listening to music or playing music or, you know, in my case, it was always very radio-based, but did music play a role in your upbringing?
Yeah, very much. Yeah. I find, I wish I had brought the picture of my first birthday, my big celebration birthday, which was on the 15th. Yeah. So in our culture, music plays a big role, but not so much radio as in music played in, well, obviously in church, but also on birthdays, you know, and a band. It's a band that plays music or a DJ. But if you really want to showcase, you have a band. So for my 15th birthday, my mom said, okay, well, you can have a birthday party. And then the discussion was, okay, so what's going to be music? Because music is so central. If there is no music, it is not a party. Yeah. There needs to be music. And it needs to be music that's going to be engaging. Obviously, it couldn't be a band because my mom didn't have the money for a band. So it was a DJ, but then a DJ who would also dance. And he was a friend of ours. But my birthday party turned into a whole bubbling party because bubbling music was the music for our age range, but also for the area where I was born, close to Guyana. Bubbling influences comes from Guyana. And he would play music, but also dance. So music is prominent, yes, but rather life music.
But a very social way of engaging with music.
Social way, that's it.
How did lockdown then affect your family members?
A lot. Yeah. Huge impact. In Suriname, you could also see that, you know, the radio was trying to compromise this situation with not being able to engage with live music, because live music is such a prominent thing in our life. So what happened during lockdown, not only in Suriname, but also for the Surinamese community in Holland, that those music bands would rent a space and have online, music, online parties. And you could tune in and you could see them play online, and that's how they compromise the situation with you know, not being able to have this live band music on your
And did that work? Because I've seen people do that with choirs. I don't know how. I'm sure that they must all be out of step with one another, because obviously connections, if you're supposed to sing at a certain moment, then somebody's obviously going to sort of be half a second behind someone else, and it's all out of so you could never perform it live. But did that work? Was that successful? I mean, even if, you know, obviously you do it through a form of technology, but it's a substitute.
Yes.
But did it, was it good enough?
It was a compromise. And for us, we went creative. And thank God for, all these icons on WhatsApp, Instagram, and all.
Like emojis and all that.
The emojis.
Sort of thing. Yeah.
So if you want to show your excitement, you respond by showing up an emoji that's dancing. Yeah. And if it was music related to, for instance, the area where we are from, my husband and I are from, you know, an area that very much relates to coconut trees. The band would play a song that represents our area. We would have coconut trees putting up. So that's how you engaged with the musicians and with people.
And what about things like, I mean, particular inspirational figures, whether it's to do with religion or through school or university, teachers that inspired you, that you may or may not still be in touch with these days? Did you have any of those?
I'm thinking of a teacher that has inspired, well, not so much inspired, because but he was a friend of my dad, and he was teaching my sisters and he had played a big role in my sister taking part in some challenge. But if I think of inspiring figures, can't really say. Well, of course, we had those pop artists that you would, you know, be inspired by. And I'm thinking, which were they? I don't even remember. I know that we also had a lot of posters. You would get these posters in the pop magazines. Yeah. Posters of Michael Jackson, posters of Boy George, posters of Madonna. And you would dress like Madonna. There was this time where you had these reflector, how do you say it? Reflector bracelets.
Bangles.
Yes, yeah. Bangles. Yeah. Because Madonna had these bangles, so we would have these bangles as well. Tina Turner with the big hair, and all of a sudden you felt great that you have big hair.
Yeah.
So and then obviously, indeed. Well, in my after my 15th birthday party, that's where you move from the district to the city. Because that also signifies you're 15, you're ready to go to the big school. That's what they call it. And that's the other school, the college, is not in the district, but in the city. And coming in the city, it's a complete different exposure to life. Because in the district, it's much more of a, you know, subtle or safe situation. In the big city, you're exposed to everything. And that's where we would have artists like dance hall.
Right.
So we say bubbling music. The dance hall music is much more with influences from Jamaica and from Guyana.
Yeah.
And it has a little bit of reggae inspiration in it, but it's much more lively. And there was this artist, Patra. They called her Patra with the dreads all the way to the end. So that became an inspiration with the bandanas and you know, so these type of artists became inspirations. Butchu Banton, those.
And you happen to have a photograph of you with Bob Marley's the son of Bob Marley.
Yes.
I have to hear this story.
So this is the time period that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Moving from the district that I was living is Nikeri.
Yeah.
Nikeri is close to Guyana.
Yeah.
And then moving from Nikeri to Paramaribo. Paramaribo is the city, is the capital of Suriname, and that's much more vibrant. There's a lot going on. Ended up in college. I was with my friend, and no, actually I was already married here. So, but my friend and I, who I met when I went to college, she and I have been friends from since we've been in college, and she is Indian, but she is such a big fan of reggae, and Bob Marley is her idol.
Yeah.
So there was this reggae festival in the capital, in Paramaribo, organized, and Bob Marley's son was there with a lot of other artists. I am a fan of Bob Marley, yes, but much more of his son, Kimani. I just, because of the films that he has, starred in. So my friend and I, we were just walking on High Street, you could say, the High Street. And there he was sitting on a terrace. And my friend was like, shall we go? Shall we ask him? Because I didn't see him. She saw him and she froze. And I was like, she froze and I didn't know why. And she kept pointing in the direction of the terrace. And that's where I saw him sitting.
You see, those moments can go at least two ways. One is what seems to have happened, that it's amazing, and you've got the photograph, and I'm sure that there's more to the story.
Yeah, yeah.
The other angle is the bit that would make me very reluctant to go up, but then regret not going up for the rest of my life, which is what happens if you go up and they turn you away.
Yeah,
and you think, hang on, you're my idol. I've invested all this trust in you, and I love your music, and I've paid all this money and invested all, you know, emotional energy, traveled to see you in concert, and you just brush me away. But it has a happy ending.
Yeah. This is the happy ending. I mean, it's very much down to earth. This is an artist that is used to, you know, idols coming up to him.
Yeah.
So my friend didn't want to go. But I said, I'm going because that's Kimani Mali. What is the chance that I will meet Kimani Mali sitting on a terrace again? So I'm going. But I was, of course, nervous as hell. But I still went. And I asked, can I have a picture? Can I take a picture with you? And I said, yes, of course. And as you can see, the picture, it's like we're friends.
And this was taken in the days before selfies.
Of course.
But which makes it all the cachet value there. Yeah. Of actually, because these days it's very easy to just say, hey. You know,
snap.
But here you have to have somebody else who does it for you.
My friend took the picture. Yeah.
When would this have been? What sort of era would this have been?
Well, this is the thing. If I look at the age... Well, you never ask a woman her age.
Oh, no. Well, I'm not... Okay, we'll...
Let's see, I was here, well, I was married when I was 21, so it's somewhere around 25, I would say,
Yeah. No, and in doing that, has that changed your apprehension of him, his music? Because he obviously seems a really nice guy, you have that photograph, and that was a good moment, but do you listen more now than you did? Is that, you know, the idea of having that accessibility, maybe that's the key word, because you kind of want your idols to be a bit different to everybody else. They're special. They're on a different plane.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't see Madonna sitting there or Tina Turner sitting there and go up and talk to them. You wouldn't expect that.
Yeah.
And you kind of know that's what they represent.
Mm.
But this is obviously a far more personal,
yeah,
momentous event for you.
Yeah. Obviously, after that day, it was all Bob Marley music. Yeah. It was all Kimani. I would watch the film over and over again. And like I said, my husband was going crazy. Yeah. But then after a while, it fades away. Because you're going through stages in life. And then it becomes not so much important anymore. Obviously, you will have some periods in time where you do listen to reggae music. You watch the films that are related to him. But it hasn't become such a big part of my life anymore. When I go to the picture, I relive the moment. But it's not that it's no, I have to listen to Bob Marley now.
Yeah. And what about the educational journey? Because you're doing a PhD. How did that journey start for you? So in terms of like your first degree, where did you study? What subjects did you do? Anthropology, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Like I said, I started in Wageningen. Wageningen is part of Nikeri, and Nikeri is a district in Suriname, and it's close to Guyana. And this is the thing, in Suriname we have a completely different education system. So in Wageningen I went up to the middle school, and middle school, if I have to compare it to English, British school system, it would be 11th grade, 11th.
So secondary school.
Secondary school. From secondary school, went to Paramaribo, and that's where I went into college. And my focus was on languages, so Spanish, but also on economics. And when I finished my college, I did my bachelor's in social cultural development, which translates as a social worker. I could work as a social worker, but I could also function as a community developer. So doing community development work. And I've done that for years. I've worked as a project manager, assistant to the project manager, which was related to working with grassroots women. But I've also worked as a social worker, and it was in the capacity of a social worker that I moved to Sint Maarten to work as a social worker there. But in Suriname, I've also taught because I also, besides my bachelor's in sociocultural development, I've also worked as on, I've also done my degree for teaching. So I have a teacher's degree where I am allowed to teach social studies.
Yeah.
And that I have done in Suriname as well. And after I finished my bachelor's, I didn't do any studies for quite a while. It's only recently, so 5 years ago, since I came to England, that I picked up my master's in social anthropology. Mm. In Suriname, they don't have studies in anthropology. Obviously, we have the university, but the university in sociology and all of that, and I wasn't interested in that. I was interested in social anthropology. So I did my master's in social anthropology here and now my PhD. And with my master's was also related to visual anthropology.
And of course, the inevitable question, how did you end up in Canterbury of all places?
That's a good one.
You've been right around the world, but why here?
Through Google. I'm not lying. It's Google.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, when I was in St. Martin, I had the possibility of doing my studies because I wanted to do social anthropology. And I could do it online at the University of the West Indies, or I could go to Holland. I didn't want to go to Holland because the majority of our friends and family lives in Holland. And if you're around them, there's nothing can happen with studies because my husband and I were mature students. So we said, okay, the next one in line is England. And why? It's English. You speak English. In St. Martin, we do speak English. And if it's social anthropology, England has colonized Suriname as well. So I would definitely find traces of history of Suriname and England here as well. So I've asked a colleague of mine in St. Martin, and two of his daughters were studying in England, but in Birmingham. And he said, I don't want to be in Birmingham. I want to be at a university that's a bit a representation of Europe, so a much diverse university, and looking up universities that teach anthropology, but also with the opportunity of a bit of a diverse, that's where University of Kent came up.
And could you ever have imagined all those years ago that you'd end up anywhere near here?
Never. Yeah. No. But it's because of this situation with my heart that I took the initiative and I made the change of leaving Suriname, because it was always, I will never ever leave Suriname. Suriname is where I was born. Suriname is my heart, is where my heart is. I will never leave Suriname. Mm. That's how the situation with my heart came up.
And it's interesting how, I mean, I think of my grandparents who, if it hadn't been for the Second World War, would have stayed in their villages.
Yeah.
And they would have married different people because they were both engaged, I think. And then the Second World War came along and they had to leave their hometowns and they met and the rest is history. But it's interesting, isn't it, how that notion of travel and that notion of what is within within the comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
That I'm very good that I have no problem travelling, but I tend to stay a long time in places. You know, I'm not, I never have itchy feet, or if I try to sort of, think, what are the new challenges? And there are plenty of them in any place where I am. And so the rest of the world sometimes can sort of feel like uncharted territory. But in making that sort of sound, because the question I was going to come to, which you've actually already answered about whether you can be nostalgic about negative experiences. I think in your case, it sounds as though something horrible happened where you thought and what that must have done to you and your family and knowing that you didn't have much longer to live.
Yeah.
And then there was obviously a happy ending in that, or slightly bittersweet in the sense that it was like, well, hang on a minute. But if it hadn't been for that, you perhaps
wouldn't have
taken all these opportunities and chances, which paradoxically means that sometimes, to some degree anyway, bad things are good for us because they give us the chance to sort of say, hang on a minute, how can I overcome this? But it has to be within certain reasonable constraints. What happened to you sounds extraordinarily just horrible.
Yeah. You know, that's where my Christian belief kicks in. Yeah. Because as a Christian, you believe that nothing happens, everything happens for a reason. And as a Christian, you're always pursuing your purpose in life. Why is it that I am in this earth, on this earth?
Yeah.
And when that happened, when the news came that I wouldn't live that long, it was an attack on my faith as a Christian as well. I didn't know where to go with my whole Christianity thing. And I didn't want to know anything about God. That's where I said, everything goes in the back burner. I'm going to live my life the way I want because I obviously don't have much time to live. And when I came out of the recovery room in Colombia, my husband had on a t-shirt, and on the t-shirt it was written, reborn to live.
Yeah.
And no, reborn to be, no. It was a sentence with reborn, but it was actually signifying that it's a new beginning. So the word reborn was there. And that's the first thing that I saw when I woke up, when I came out of the, how do you say it?
Surgery?
Yeah. That's the first thing that I saw, the reborn thing. And I've always, that's where my Christian belief in God came back.
Yeah.
From since then, that's what I keep in mind. You know, any challenge that I have to face, like I said also in the beginning, I don't have that much of a fear anymore because of that Christian faith. Mm. And to answer your question, what would have happened? I don't look back. Yeah. I see it as my journey. That's the journey that has been assigned to me. You know, when I was born, obviously when you're born, you don't know yet what your journey is going to be like. But me looking back, that was my journey. That had to happen in order for me to move out of Suriname to become who I was supposed to, or who I am supposed to become. And that's why my encounter, my engagement with Arthur, the Peace Corps, also fits in. Because when I met Arthur, there was no way I thought about even moving out of Suriname. I was exposed to the American culture. I was exposed to the American way of doing things. But I had no idea that I would ever be living in a European, westernized society.
And are you still in touch with friends from the past? I guess social media helps.
Yes.
But...
Yeah. I'm still, well, this friend who took this picture, Angela, definitely. We are still friends till this day. Arthur, like I've mentioned. But also for my first job was a government job, and I had two older friends. That's also where I met my husband, and we are still in touch with each other. They could be my mom, but we are still friends. One of my colleagues from when I was doing my bachelor, just 2 months ago, if it's 2 months or 3 months ago, Ingrid, she lives in Holland. I had no idea that she lived in Holland. Mm. She moved from Suriname. I didn't even know where she moved to. And through the whole lockdown situation thing, you're more focused on Facebook. That's how we got in touch again. And then she came to visit London, a family, and she and I met. We met up, and when we reconnected, it was like old times. Yes. Yeah,
and that does happen, doesn't it? Sometimes that you pick up, you know, conversationally where you left off.
Oh yes,
and you suddenly think, "Hang on a minute, you know, this is wonderful, but also very surreal."
Yes. That was exactly with me and Ingrid, because we were sitting in the Westfield Mall at Stratford. That's where I went to meet her, and the first thing when we met is like, "You haven't changed." And then we started to talk about our time in the university. And that's where we started to call other friends' names. Do you remember this one? Do you remember that one? What was her name again? Oh, yeah, what is she doing? Do you remember the day that... And it was so funny that we were talking about a time in my life when I was not even thinking about doing a PhD, not even thinking about living in Europe, yet I was sitting there with her. Talking about our time in Suriname,
And I think you've actually answered my very last question about whether you're a looking back or a looking forward kind of person. But the reason I ask again is because I think it's really interesting that you're such a reflective person, but you're also somebody, and it's very clear that there's this almost sort of, maybe in the light of what happened with your heart, that there's a sense that what will be will be, that you're meant to be on a particular journey point, and that you're fully embracing that.
Yes. I'm a person who lives through the past, in the present, looking at the future. So they are all three very much part of me. So my past comes with me. It's just part of me. It's here. You know, my present is what I experience now, but it's through my past that I also look at my future. Like I said, what happened to me in the past for me determines how I look at what's going to come in the future. Makes me look at the future either in a positive or a much more fearful way. But in my case, it's a positive way because I feel like I have overcome the challenge. I have crossed the bridge, and now I'm on my way to.
Well, that is such a hopeful way to end. Rachel, it's been a delight. Thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Thank you so much for having me and listening to my Bravo.